Thank you. Thank you. God bless you. You may be seated. Well, I love your pastor and his wife, Lisa, and every one of you. And I want to thank you especially for coming out tonight. I didn't think I did a good job last night. And I thought, nobody's going to be here tonight, Friday night. So you blessed me by showing up. Anyway, so tonight I'm going to talk about the history of slavery and the abolitionist movement. And I think you'll find it interesting. And I've got lots of information that I can't fit into the times. So I may skip past a bunch of slides, and hopefully that won't be too distracting. But with your permission, I'll go ahead and get started. So slavery existed from the beginning of recorded history, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and so forth. Even the beginning of writing, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. So, right, take a stick, poke it in clay. That's the beginning of writing. So the very first things that were written have slaves, right? 2050 BC, the word for king is lugal, free person is lu, male slave is arad, female slave is jemi. I mean, so there's always been slavery. Here's Hammurabi. He's a contemporary of Abraham. And he said, okay, there's God, king, male nobles, wives of the male nobles, and then the poor, and then the slaves. So there's always been slavery. And here's one. Hammurabi's code says that they're slaves, slave auctioned, slaves are tattooed with their owner's names. And then here's Hammurabi's code, law number 282. If a slave says to his master, you are not my master, if they convict him, his master shall cut off his ear. And then China. In the ancient China, actually in the Shang Dynasty, second millennium BC, enslaved neighboring states used captives for ritual sacrifice. And there's a word in the Shang and Dao dynasties, jiamin, which means base or debtor, and so they had slavery. And anyway, Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, and then Egyptians had slaves, and obviously the Israelites, and the Gibeonite deception. Instead of Joshua having would kill them, because they had tricked him into making a treaty, Joshua says, okay, we're not going to kill you, but you will be water carriers and chop wood as a class of people. So that was, in a sense, like slavery. And then India, they have a caste system. And the highest is the Brahmin, they're near divinity, and the lowest is the untouchables, and their job is to clean the sewers. And even if they do a really good job, they can never graduate and so forth. Ancient Greece, about 40% of Athens was slaves. And then the Romans captured, Julius Caesar. It was Gallic Wars, went all through Europe and captured people and brought them back into Rome. And the people that he captured were Slavs. That's where you get the word Yugoslav, Czechoslav, Slovenia, Slovakia. And the word Slav meant glorious one. It was a name of a people group. But the Romans captured so many of them and gave them away as permanent servants that the word Slav got the connotation of a permanent servant. And, of course, we pronounce it slave. And then you had Diocletian. And then Jesus. The movement to get rid of slavery started with Jesus. And he, therefore, all things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So if you don't want to be a slave, you shouldn't own a slave. I thought it was interesting, some stories that we're all aware of that we don't really think of. But the most popular Greek Orthodox saint is Saint Nicholas. And the Greek Orthodox tradition was that he had decided to... The Pietist movement, remember I talked about that yesterday? That he decided he was going to serve the Lord and give away all his money and join a monastery. But he wanted to give away the money anonymously so God would get the glory and not him. And so he would sneak into town and throw money in the window of poor people. And the famous story was a merchant was bankrupt and the creditors were going to take his three daughters and, like repo, but only they'd probably have a life of, horrible slavery and prostitution probably. And so Nicholas hears the problem and late one night throws some money in the window, providing the dowry for the girls to get married and so they don't have to be sold into slavery. And so that became the idea of St. Nicholas visiting at nighttime, and then they threw the money in the window and supposedly landed in a shoe or stockings that were drying by the fireplace, and we celebrate that tradition. And it says, he provides a dowry for three girls. So that's where St. Nicholas is throwing the money in the window. And then Constantine stops the persecution of Christian, and then slavery begins to diminish. And then in the 5th century, invading hordes overrun the Roman Empire, and they enslave the captives. And then a famous story that we're familiar with is Patrick. So Britain was a Roman colony from the time of Julius Caesar all the way up until the 5th century. And then Attila the Hun is scourging Europe. Rome has to pull all of its legions back from the frontiers, and Britain's left unprotected. And that's when marauding bands come and capture people and sell them into slavery. And so Patrick was kidnapped and sold into slavery in Druid, Ireland. And then he escapes, and then he goes back as an adult, as a missionary, and he converts 300,000 people and so forth. But it started off with him being a slave. So Patrick was a slave for 6 years in Druid, Ireland. And then you had Patrick writes what's considered the first anti-slavery document. So he gets Ireland all saved, but then there's a British king named Caroticus who is capturing Irish that Patrick brought to Christian faith, and he's taking them and making them slaves. And Patrick condemns this guy and says, you're selling the bride of Christ into a brothel. This is what Patrick writes. The sheep around me are torn to pieces, driven away by these robbers, by the orders of the hostile-minded Caroticus, so forth. Ravening wolves that devour the flock of the Lord. You sell them to foreign nation that has no knowledge of God. You betray the members of the body of Christ, and so forth. Anyway, then Islam comes along, and they enslave because Muhammad himself owned slaves. Muhammad owned black slaves. In Arabic, there is one word for black person and slave. It's the same word. It's abd or abid, A-B-E-D, abid. And so every black person, the Muslims would call them slave. It's just the same word. And so they enslaved an estimated 180 million Africans in the 1400 years of Islam. Muhammad was white. There are hadiths that when he'd lift his arms to pray, they'd see the whiteness of his armpits. And somebody was on his donkey, and it rubbed up against Muhammad. He says, I saw the whiteness of the prophet's thigh. And another hadith says some people came to visit Muhammad. They said he is the white man reclining on the couch. And Muhammad owned black slaves, and he sold them. And so it's impossible. There's never been an abolitionist movement in Islam because it would be considered an insult to Muhammad. Now, there have been some that wanted to move away from that, like Ataturk in Turkey wanted to have a secular state. But as far as the fundamentalist Muslim countries, that's their dilemma, because if they criticize owning of slaves, they're criticizing Muhammad. And Saladin, remember the Third Crusade? You got Richard the Lionheart, and he's got his brother King John is running England. Remember Robin Hood, Sherwood Forest time? And so Richard is over there fighting Saladin, and he almost takes Jerusalem but doesn't. And they broker to let the Christians out of Jerusalem, and Saladin lets everybody that can ransom their life out, but about 15,000 don't have money to ransom their life, and he sells them into slavery. And twice as many women were sold in Arab Muslim slave trade than men, and they had slave markets. All Timbuktu, where the canoe meets the caravan, the Niger River was a big Arab slave trading port. Khartoum in Sudan, the Zanzibar coast, Tanzania. There's hundreds of Muslim slave markets where they would sell Africans. And anyway, unfortunately, they would have the men work and take care of the harems, and they would castrate them and so forth. Even David Livingstone, the Scottish missionary to the Congo, would write about going through the jungle and stumbling across 500 Africans shackled together, being forced to march 500 miles to the coast. And if they were walking too slow, they'd slow everybody down because they're shackled together. They just shoot them or kill them. He says you could tell where the slave trails were by looking for the vultures circling. And he says, if anything, more important than discovering the source of the Nile River, if my revelations can get rid of this monster that hangs over Africa of the Arab Muslim slave trade. And Jedediah Morris wrote the first geography books for America. And he writes, the island of Madagascar has several petty savage kings of its own, both Arab and Negro, who, making war on each other, sell their prisoners for slaves and so forth. And then you have the Vikings, and they had boats with low keels, and they would go up every river in Europe, into Russia, all these places where people thought they were safe, and they'd get off their boats, and they'd kill the men and throw the women over their shoulders and sail back to Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And so they had slavery, but the captured Christian women would have to have children to these Vikings, and they would raise the children to be Christian. And so after a couple generations, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark became Christian. So ladies, you did a good job there. And and then, so slavery when Ataturk set up the modern Republic of Turkey, he did want to secularize it, and so they ended that for a period. So anyway, Europeans, they were captured by the Muslims and sold into slavery. And there were entire Catholic orders called the Trinitarians. The head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations and go under a white flag to North Africa to ransom your friend back. And then Vincent de Paul was captured about the same time the Pilgrims, or the Jamestown is being founded in America. He's captured and he's made a slave, and he eventually witnesses to one of his master's wives, and she nags the husband to listen to this guy, and they let him go. And he sneaks back to Europe, and he starts an organization, a charity, to raise money at church to ransom back guys like himself who had been in the Muslim slavery. And then he starts the first hospitals. And he has an order of the Sisters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, and they run all these hospitals across Europe. The Portuguese, Columbus, when the Muslims conquered the land routes to Indian China, he set sail with a sea route in 1492. But in 1498, Vasco da Gama made it around from Portugal, around South Africa, to Goa, India, and opened up trade that way. Unfortunately, he decided to bring back some slaves, and so Portugal got involved in the slave trade. And then pre-Columbian America had slaves. Talking with Pastor Jack, that the Columbus's first journey, he met the peaceful Indians. They were called Arawaks. And then on his second journey, he's got 17 ships with 2,000 get-rich-quick people that they land on an island and they see human bones cooking in pots. And they're like, Columbus, you didn't tell us about this. We thought it was all wonderful. And find out that they're Caribs. And they had come up from South America. And they would raid the islands at nighttime and take the women and eat them. And they'd take the boys and they would eat them. And then, anyway, I won't get into all of it. But the Spanish word for a cannibal at the time was related to the word Carib or Caribbee. Or piranha. So basically, Caribbean Sea had the connotation of a cannibal sea. And then the Aztecs. The reason that Cortez, with just 500 men, was able to defeat them was because the surrounding tribes helped Cortez because they were tired of giving up their young men and women to be taken to the top of the pyramids and have their hearts ripped out, and then their bodies rolled down and people would cannibalize them. And the Cortez's men wrote stories about this, and for centuries, people doubted it. But just a few years ago, they were digging and doing repairs to the old buildings and cathedrals in downtown Mexico City, and they got down way down in the basement, and they've uncovered these whole areas of thousands of skulls, and a lot of them are babies, and so they're not captured in war. They were, anyway. So you already had dinner, so I'd be telling these stories. You know, guys sort of like hearing these stories, and ladies don't, and so I'd be at the table, and I said, my wife's like, we're eating dinner, don't talk about this. And so, the North America, wasn't it a beautiful place before the Europeans came? Well, the Comanches of Texas owned slaves. The Creeks in Georgia owned slaves. The Yurok in Northern California owned slaves. The Pawnee, the Kalmuck, they all did. I talked to somebody that had been a missionary to the Dakotas, and he talked about their history, that every summer the whole tribe would relocate down by the cliffs, by the river, and to hide the tribe, because the men would go off to raid another tribe to take their women. But while they're gone, another tribe would raid their tribe and take their women. And it was sort of a... Anyway. Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. So you got Socrates taught Plato. Plato taught Aristotle. Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. And Aristotle taught Alexander that the Greeks were superior and the other ones were barbarians. And it was okay to enslave the barbarians. And so that's one of the reasons Alexander the Great conquered everything, because he mentally thought that he was superior and they weren't. But this is typical. You had just about every nationality had an equivalent of this. The Inca Empire, in a sense, everybody in the Inca Empire was a slave. Everybody was employed by the state, and the head of the state was Atahualpa, and he was a delegate of the sun god. And so, but it's a natural human tribalism that you have, you know, ancient American history, rather, the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? These are two families that they just kept, you know, for centuries. And then you have, you know, Cubans and Haitians and the Pharisees, Samaritans. You know, they wouldn't go through that. Well, the Samaritans, they're bad. And I was even in Texas one time, and the big deal is football. And one town will hate the other town because of a football team rivalry. And it's like there's this natural tendency toward tribalism. The gospel comes along and it shakes things up. It says, no, 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 all men are created equal in the image of God. And God is not a respecter of persons, that everyone is to be treated the same. And so Columbus, he takes four voyages, and he's convinced he's this close to China. He's trying to fit what, you know, Marco Polo had gone to China in the 1200s, across the Gobi Desert, the China Silk Road, and his book was handwritten before they had the printing press, and they would copy it and copy it all, and it became a bestseller, Marco Polo's Journeys. It was nicknamed Il Milione's, which means the million lies, because they said, naked holy men in India. It's like, yeah, right, you know, and then they'd have fields of cloth, and he evidently hadn't seen coal before. He's like, these burning rocks in China, but it was coal. And so Columbus knew there was China, and he knew some rudimentary geography, and so he was trying to fit the Caribbean geography into what he had thought was the China and the Far East and the, you know. So he, on his second voyage, he's got these 2,000 get-rich-quick guys, and he leaves his brother in charge, and he's doing some more exploring, and then gets back, and some of them had mutinied, and they went off and took a lot of the natives as captives, and Columbus writes a letter to the monarchs in Spain saying, I need help, and this jealous bishop named Fonseca convinces the king to replace Columbus with a guy named Bobadilla, and so Bobadilla shows up in Cuba and puts Columbus in chains and sends him back in the hull of a ship in chains. And of course, he gets back, the king and queen take it off, but they're not in a hurry to send him on another trip. But meanwhile, so they enslave more of the natives, and there's a guy named Bartolomé de las Casas, and he was a slave raider. He would raid the islands and he'd take the Indians captive, and they basically set up a feudal system in America, like in Europe. So Europe, you have the feudal lord, and his job was to, you know, run this plantation, so to speak, you know, with all the people, and he would consider them his servants. And so they set that up in the New World and said, okay, this is my encomienda, this is my, and they would make the Native Americans as slaves, make them work in mines, dig for gold, and then with a lot of the European diseases, there was a lot of dying. And so Bartolomé de las Casas converted. So he's a contemporary of Martin Luther. So Martin Luther's doing the Reformation over in Europe,
And Bartolomé de las Casas, he goes and he hears a sermon. And he says, the voice of the crying out in the wilderness. And he convicts him that he's a sinner, taking all these slaves. And so he repents and he decides to become a priest. And then he spends the rest of his life lobbying to end the enslavement of Native Americans. And he gets a little plantation going where the Native Americans are all farming and becoming successful, and then they get raided by the other ones and they're killed, and they wipe the whole thing out. But he even does a debate with a Spanish guy named Sepulveda. I think there's a street somewhere out here named that. And you know what the debate was about? Whether or not the Native Americans had souls. And Sepulveda said that they were not fully human, they really didn't have souls, so it's okay to enslave them. And Bartolomé de las Casas said, no, they're fully human just like you are, they have souls, and it's wrong to enslave them. And they even made a movie about that called The Controversy of Valladolid. So finally, Bartolomé de las Casas is successful, got the King of Spain, got the Pope to make decrees to stop the enslavement of Native Americans. And this is wonderful, but somebody said, well, if we can't enslave them, where can we get slaves? And someone said, Africa. And that began the African slave trade to the New World. So there's two threads that trace through history, greed and the gospel. You will always have people motivated by greed, and they're the ones that sell people into slavery, take land from Indians, grow opium in India and ship it into China. Right? That's what the British did. Talk about being involved in drug trafficking. The government was doing it. And those that are motivated to vote for candidates they think that will help their pocketbook or give them a welfare check, even though they may be standing for abortion, right? But you always have people motivated by greed. And you always have people motivated by the gospel. And they're the ones that go into villages and dig wells and start medical clinics and go help people. And so you always have these two threads, greed and the gospel. And they cut through that. Cuts through each and every one of our hearts. Every day we're faced with that decision. Are we going to do what's greedy and what's helpful to us now? Or are we going to do the gospel and walk in love and walk in forgiveness? And so it's the human condition. So now that you don't enslave Native Americans, the Portuguese and Spanish, and then eventually the Dutch and the British and French begin to go to the Muslim slave markets and buy slaves. And begins to fuel this, and then you had different tribes would conquer other tribes, and then they would sell them, and so forth. And notice on the right side of that map, they're being sold from the Zanzibar coast over to India and Arabia. There's no Europeans doing that, right? That is just 100% Arab Muslim slave trading going on. Right? You can see that on the side there, on the right side of the map. So they were brought to the New World, primarily to Brazil, then the Caribbean and Cuba. They worked on sugar and coffee and cocoa plantations. More African slaves were brought into Brazil than to any other country. An estimated 4.9 million were brought by the Portuguese. Only 500,000 were brought to North America, primarily work on cotton plantations. Let's see. Then there is another chapter where sort of talking about the human condition is England was Catholic, and then Henry VIII decides to split and start the Anglican Church, and then he has a daughter named Mary who wants to make it Catholic again, and she's married to the King of Spain, Philip, and she dies, but Philip says, hey, I was married to the queen, I should take it, and so he wants to take back, and he does the Spanish Armada, right? Then it sunk. Then he does another Armada, and then one time he lands in Ireland. And he goes, well, you guys are Catholic in Ireland, and we're Catholic in Spain, and let's team up together and invade England, and the British attack back. It's called the Battle of Kinsale in 1601, and the British win. And so the Spaniards sail away, but the Irish can't sail away. And so during this time, about 500,000 Catholic Irish are killed, and another 500,000 are sold into slavery and on plantations in the Caribbean and in Virginia, and they're treated harshly because of religious animosities. There's a book, Sean O'Callaghan, To Hell or Barbados. However, from 1625 onward, the Irish were sold pure and simple as slaves. There were no indentured agreements, no protection, no choice. They were captured and originally turned over to shippers to be sold for profit. And because the profits were so great, generally around 900 pounds of cotton for a slave, the Irish slave trade became an industry in which everyone involved, except the Irish, had a share in the profits. And one of the pilgrim ships in 1625, the pilgrims had saved up 800 pounds of beaver skins and sent it back, and their ship was captured by Muslim pirates in the English Channel, and the crew was taken to Morocco and sold into slavery. So in Morocco, you had a Muslim sultan named Moulay Ismail, and he had captured over 25,000 Europeans, and they were building him his palace at Mequinez, and he had hundreds of wives and a record 1,042 children. But they were mostly white women that he had captured from different raiding parties and so forth. And Squanto. So you read in the gospel, you know, the pilgrims were religiously motivated, but you had some of the other ones that weren't. And they would go along the coast of America, lure some naive Indians on board, and then lock them below deck and go over to Spain and sell them into the slave markets. And one of those was Squanto. So he was captured, and some monks found out about it, and they rescued Squanto and gave him his freedom. He hitchhikes his way back to England, and he lives and works in England for like a dozen years. And then he finally finds a shipping business that takes him to Newfoundland, and another one drops him off there at Plymouth, only to find out his entire tribe is dead, wiped out by a plague. And he's living with another tribe, and then the next spring is when the pilgrims are there. And Squanto walks out of the woods, and he speaks to them in perfect English. Oh, you guys from England? Yeah, I used to live there. the St. Paul's Chapel down on Wharf Street. Oh, yeah, that pub. Yeah, I know. Oh, here, I grew up here. I know this place like the back of my hand. And so William Bradford says that Squanto was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He showed them how to catch fish, showed them how to plant corn, showed them how to catch beaver. Did you know it took 40 years worth of beaver skins for the pilgrims to pay off that boat ride? Anyway, but he rescued them. So the spiritual application is sometimes we go through painful times, right? I mean, here all of his life, he wanted to get back to his family, and they're all dead. Talk about disillusionment and depression and discouragement. But out of that pain, he ended up rescuing and saving all of these pilgrims. And so sometimes when you go through pain and it looks hopeless and you wonder where is God in it all, that trust the Lord through it. And he will turn it around where you will be able to minister to people in a way that nobody else can and touch their heart and save their lives even for eternity. And so 17th century progressed, the African slave trade increased, Dutch, French, English, and the first African slaves were brought to Virginia, 1619, a Dutch ship. They had, were starving, and they had some slaves, and they traded them for supplies. And the slaves were originally indentured servants, and every one of them was freed after 7 years. And then you have some of the freed slaves owned slaves. And one of them was the story of Anthony Johnson and John Castor. So Anthony Johnson was an African from Angola, arrives in Virginia as a slave. After his 7 years, he's freed. And he becomes a tobacco plantation farmer, and he has acreage, and he has a number of slaves, and one of them is John Castor. And after 7 years, John Castor expects to be freed, so he walks away and goes working on another farm. Well, Anthony Johnson brings a lawsuit and wins to make John Castor a permanent slave. So the first permanent, by law, was Anthony Johnson from Angola owning John Castor. And again, sad chapter, but we're talking human nature, and it's fallen, and it's selfish, and people need to be born again. I use it as a software analogy. You're a spirit, mind, and body. Your mind is like a super fancy computer. It's more than that, but it's at least that. and your body's like the computer case, which makes it silly for people to argue over what color the computer case is. Imagine people saying, hey, red phones are better than green phones. It's like, doesn't matter what color the phone is. What matters is what apps are on it. Doesn't matter what color the computer is. It's what software's on it. Doesn't matter what color somebody's skin is. It's what software is running in their brain, right? Is it the gospel? Love your enemies. Pray for those that hurt you. Do unto others as you would have them do. Whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me. Or is it the default setting that you imagine by a computer's got a default setting? Well, the default setting for our human software is selfishness, right? And so the battle is who gets to load the software on the next generation's brains, right? Instead of sending critical race theory people into the schools, we need to send evangelists into the schools. Get the kids born again, and then teach them that God wants them to do unto the least of these what you do unto the Lord, right? And so, England. During the Middle Ages, there were no companies. It was a sin of usury to buy, to pay or receive interest. So there were no companies. If you wanted to do something big, like sail around the world looking for spices, you had to hit up a rich guy or a king. Sir Walter Raleigh personally spent 30,000 pounds silver trying to initially settle Jamestown or Roanoke, Virginia, and he lost it all. So nobody wanted to do it. But then they invented companies. And then the Dutch were the ones that started the Dutch East India Company. So anybody, baker and butcher, candlestick maker, could invest money in a boat going to Indonesia. When it came back full of nutmeg or cinnamon, you got paid a profit. And if you wanted to sell your interest in the boat while it's at sea, you would go down to the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. And then if the boat sank or was captured by the Muslim pirates or whoever else, that's when the Dutch invented insurance companies. Right? And so then the British decide they're going to do companies. Now, there are companies. It's not anybody. It's just the rich people sort of pool their money, but it's still a company. And the king found out that if he gave some rich guys a monopoly on trading with, Russia, with the Muscovy Company or the British East India, if he gave a set of guys a monopoly, then he would let them bring their goods back to England and pay him a profit. This way, he didn't have to risk any money. He didn't have to get involved at all. If it goes belly up and nothing happens, he didn't lose anything. But if they make money, he gets a percentage. And so he started the British East India Company and then the Virginia Company that started. And then off of the Virginia Company, you got the Massachusetts London Company, the Pilgrims. But then they started the Royal African Company. And yes, they bought slaves in Africa, and the king got a part of it, and they brought them to the New World. And so the Royal African Company was founded in 1672, brought an estimated 100 slaves to the New World, and the king stopped every effort of the colonies to stop slavery. So you had Quakers and others trying to stop slavery in their colonies, and the king said no, and he would sabotage their efforts. Some of the Indians in America would own other Indians, and some of the Cherokee, Choctaw, and so forth, they actually owned African slaves. And there was actually, in 1842, a black slave revolt on a Cherokee Indian territory, and 300 slaves tried to escape to Mexico. So now, how are you going to do that? You've got, Cherokee owning Africans. And again, it's the human condition of selfishness that needs to be reprogrammed. William Penn settles Pennsylvania, and 2 years later, some of these Quakers draw up the first document to end slavery in America. 1688, it's called the Germantown Petition. They even have a historical marker for it. First protest against slavery here, 1688, home of the Tuns Kunders, eloquent protest written by a group of German Quakers, signed by Pastorius and three others. It was preceded by 92 years of Pennsylvania's passage of the 92 years later, they passed the first state abolition law. So a Quaker in Philadelphia is Anthony Benezet, and he starts a school to teach black children, and then he writes a book on the horrors of the slave trade, and it begins to be read by all the leaders in America. And as they read it, they turn away from slavery. So today, more people are becoming pro-life. Well, back then, it was more people are becoming against slavery. But it was a growing movement. And you would have some people that were slave owners, and they read Anthony Bennett's book, and then they decided to stop being slave owners and want to work to free the slaves. And so, thank God, they went through this transition. So Anthony Bennett, in 1766, wrote warning to Great Britain on the calamitous state of the enslaved Negroes that slavery contradicted the precepts of the example of Christ. Bondage imposed on the Africans is absolutely repugnant, abhorrent, utterly from the Christian religion. And then he founds the first anti-slavery society. First anti-slavery society in America was founded by Christians, Quaker Christians, and then Ben Franklin ended up becoming the president of it. Patrick Henry writes this on the evils of the slave trade, 1773. I take this opportunity to acknowledge receipt of Anthony Bennett's book Against the Slave Trade. I thank you for it. I will not, I cannot justify it, justify slavery, because he had owned slaves. And he goes, I can't justify it anymore. It's wrong. And so he proposed in the Virginia legislature a bill to end the importation of slaves into Virginia. And it passed. And so Jedediah Morris wrote the first geography history book in America. It says, in October of 1786, an act was passed by the Virginia Assembly prohibiting the importation of slaves into the Commonwealth upon penalty. And then we're now free from Britain, and you have the Northwest Ordinance, and seven states come out of this land, and the federal government says no slaves. It says, there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory. Slavery was on its way out. In the Constitution, they said that no more slaves. So the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, the coup d'etat, so it's Jefferson listing all the reasons we're rebelling against the king. And the last one, the biggest one, is the King of England has captured and enslaved a people from foreign lands that have never offended him and transported them against their will, many of them dying in the transportation thither, and the king has stopped every effort of the colonies to end this exorable commerce and humankind. I mean, it was these are items listing why we were rebelling against the king, because he was doing all these ungodly things. And they had decided that the Declaration of Independence needed to be unanimous. And South Carolina and Georgia said, we don't know if we can go along with that. And they rushed in and said, the British just invaded New York. And everybody in the Continental Congress like panics. And they said, okay, well, let's just do this declaration without the slavery part, and we'll worry about that later. How we wished they would have gotten rid of it right then and started the country off on the right foot. Well, slavery was on its way out, but then Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin. So cotton, I don't know if you've been to South Carolina or those areas. If you go there when it's cotton season, the whole entire field is white. I mean, it's sort of amazing to look at. It's like just an ocean of white. And but those little pods have these little black seeds, and it's really time-consuming to take them out. But when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, this is this thing that would have these little teeth and would pull the seeds out. And boy, now cotton becomes a big crop. And what they thought, slavery was on its way out. Now with the cotton crop becoming so an expensive or moneymaker, slavery starts growing again. But there is this movement. So Marquis de Lafayette, who helped during the revolution, he is against slavery. And so France, when they do their revolution, they get rid of slavery, except on their plantation of Haiti. They should have gotten rid of it everywhere they were. So everybody that was a slave in France was freed, but not Haiti. It was the richest colony of any European colony in the New World. The amount of sugar and the amount of money that came from Haiti, it was the most of any colony. So then there was a slave rebellion on Haiti, and the French spent 10 years trying to stop it, and hundreds of thousands of people died. But anyway, Marquis de Lafayette was one of the good guys that wanted to get rid of slavery, and he actually had an idea to, it says, after the war, Lafayette returned to France, joined the French Abolitionist Society of Friends, which are the Quakers of the blacks, and advocated for the end of the slave trade and equal rights for blacks. And then Lafayette corresponds with Washington, and George Washington writes, the scheme which you propose, because he was going to buy an island plantation in Cayman, and or Cayenne, and then free all the slaves. So Washington encourages him, the scheme which you propose has a precedent to encourage the emancipation of the black people of this country from that state of bondage in which they are held is a striking evidence of the benevolence of your heart. I shall be happy to join you in so laudable a work, but will defer going into detail of the business till I have the pleasure of seeing you. So Washington had six plantations. He begins to make them as paid hired labor. And he dies before he's able to complete that. But in his will, he does immediately free William Lee, who had fought with him in every single battle during the Revolutionary War. And William Lee actually saved his life a couple times. And he gave him a pension of $30 for the rest of his life with the option of remaining at Mount Vernon because he had injured his knee. And he chose to stay there, and he was buried there. And Washington says, in his will, to my mulatto man, William, calling himself William Lee, I give immediate freedom. I allow him an annuity for $30 during his natural life, which shall be independent of the victuals and clothes. This I give him as a testimony of my sense of his attachment to me and faithful service during the Revolutionary War. Now, why didn't Washington free all of his slaves? Well, they were intermarried with the slaves that were part of his wife's family that he didn't have the legal ability to free. And then the other thought was that it was if they were freed in an area that it was not free to be free, they could be captured by somebody else and made a slave, and they wouldn't have any recompense. And so it was, it's not a defense of that, but it's an explanation. So he frees the rest of his slaves on the death of his wife. And so he says, upon the decease of my wife, it is my will and desire that all of the slaves which I hold in my own right shall receive their freedom. Again, we wish they would have all gotten it straight. You know, someday I was thinking that maybe in the future they'll want to pull down a statue of everybody that was pro-abortion. They'll realize somewhere in the future that it really genuinely is a brand new human being at the moment of conception. And all these politicians today that think, oh, well, I'm pro-choice and I want everybody to love me, if they're going to say, pull that statue, this guy was for killing babies. And they'll take his statue out of the Capitol and so forth. Now, Richard Allen started the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church, and George Washington gave money to it. Ben Franklin gave money. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration, gave money. And so Richard Allen spoke at a eulogy for George Washington after he died. And he says, he has watched over us and viewed our degraded and afflicted state with compassion and pity. His heart was not insensible to our sufferings. And so it was a positive message there. And anyway, so we'll get past Washington. Some of the other founders were against slavery, and the Adamses, and, you know, Richard Bassett was a signer of the Constitution, and he converted from being a traditional Anglican to an on-fire Methodist. So the Methodists go to John Wesley, and he was a preacher, and then following him was George Whitefield, and it was considered, the Anglicans were considered the real strict religious type, and the Methodists at this period of time were considered the enthusiastic, you know, emotional, and they were sort of looked down upon. So Richard Bassett becomes a Methodist, and he frees all of his slaves, and he pays them as hired labor, and even rides in the carriage with them on Sunday to hear the black preacher. He goes to church with them. And another is an anti-slavery leader, Rufus King, and he goes to Harvard and fights in the Revolution, and Rufus King, signer of the Constitution. And let's see here. He says, I hold that all laws or compacts imposing any such condition as slavery upon any human being are absolutely void because they are contrary to the law of nature, which is the law of God. John Jay helped draft New York's first constitution, and he proposed it abolish slavery. And Jay writes to Livingston and Gouverneur Morris that there should be a clause against the continuation of domestic slavery. John Jay helped found the New York state society for promoting manumission, which is freeing of the slaves, and he files lawsuits on behalf of the slaves. And Jay writes to Benjamin Rush, "I wish to see all discriminations everywhere abolished, and that at that time may soon come when all our inhabitants of every color and denomination shall be free and equal partakers of our political liberty." And so we're seeing that the abolitionist movement's a growing movement, sort of like the pro-life movement, and it didn't start in the Ottoman Empire. It didn't start in Arabia. It didn't start in India. It didn't start in China. Right? You got the emperor in 5,000 years, and he's on top, and the people. It started with Christians in America wanting to get serious about following Jesus' teaching. John Jay helped found New York's African Free School and supported it financially. He even bought slaves in order to immediately free them. He says, "I purchase slaves and manumit them and free them." Jay was appointed by George Washington to be the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And anyway, as the second governor of New York, he signs Act for the Gradual Abolition of Slavery. And then he starts a Bible society. And newspaper editor Horace Greeley, 1854, says, "To Chief Justice John Jay may be attributed more than to any other man the abolition of Negro bondage in this state." Let's see here. Then you got Britain and John Newton. John Newton was a slave trader. He was a real ornery young man, and his dad was in the Navy, and so the dad sort of arranges for him to follow in his footsteps to be a cabin boy on some boat. But he had a girlfriend, and he dilly-dallied too long and showed up at the port late, and he didn't make it on the British ship. But then he gets impressed that means they catch him and they put him on another ship, and then he's like really a troublemaker, and they like trade him to another trip, and he's like a real troublemaker. Long story short, he's on a slave trading ship, and the slave trader's picking up slaves from Africa. He leaves John Newton on the slave plantation in Africa, and he becomes a slave to the slave traders. I mean, he was like really bad. And then he gets free from that, and he's like cussing, somebody gives him a book, Thomas Aquinas' Imitation of Christ, and then he reads it, and then he's on a boat, and lightning strikes and the storm, and he said he prayed for the first time, and then he ends up getting out of that, goes back to Britain, and he wants to go into the ministry, and they said, "No, you're a slave trader." But he studied, and then they give him a little parish out in the countryside, and that's when he writes hymns. And he wrote, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I can see." And he admitted that he was the wickedest of the wicked, but God saved his soul. And so there's a young British parliamentarian named William Wilberforce, and he ends up getting saved, and he thinks, "Well, I'm going to drop out of the parliament and become a preacher." And John Newton says, "No, stay in there. Stay in the government. You can do more good in the government." And so William Wilberforce ends up spending the rest of his life advocating to end slavery, right? So first, he had to end the slave trade. And he knew all the parliamentary rules, and he picked one day where there was like horse racing going on, and so everybody says, "Oh, there's nothing going on in Parliament. Let's go out and watch the horse races." And he has just the right number of people in there so that he can put forth a bill and pass it. And it's the bill to end the slave trade in the British Empire. But what about the people that are slaves? So he spends another 30 years of his life to finally get all those that are slaves freed. And so this is going on about the time that the Second Great Awakening. And he writes this: "You may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know." And Proverbs says, "Rescue those being led away to death, restrain those from stumbling toward the slaughter. If you say, 'Behold, we did not know about this,' does not he who weighs hearts consider it? Does not the one who guards your life know? Will he not repay every man according to his deeds?" It's like, "Oh, I didn't, you know, I'm not paying attention to the abortions or the slavery that's still going on." You know, there's more slavery today than at any other time in world history, right? And a whole lot of it is in Africa, and the Boko Haram, and the Niger, Mauritania, Sudan, and they have the Muslim slave, and then the sex trafficking, And then in India, they have what's called generational indebtedness, where some ancestor got in debt, and to work it off, they have to work on the farm, but because of the interest, there's no way, and the kids are born with their parents' debt, and they work their whole life, and they die, and the debt is passed on to the kids. And so there is slavery still. So 1807, British stopped the importation of slaves. Well, guess what? In 1807, Thomas Jefferson signs the act for America to stop importing slaves. Thomas Jefferson signed that he was president. And then 1828, the Democrat Party is founded by Andrew Jackson, who owned slaves. And then there's the Second Great Awakening going across America, and you have different preachers that say you got to show some fruit of being saved, and you got to do things. And so they would start societies, temperance societies, to stop all the drinking, prison reform, health and education reform, women's rights, so forth, and abolition of slavery. So the modern abolitionist slavery movement started out of the Second Great Awakening Revival. Well-known Americans, Louisa May Scott, Susan B. Anthony, Henry Ward Beecher, they're all against slavery, lots of names. And William Lloyd Garrison said, "The right to enjoy liberty is inalienable. Let us invade it. To invade it, it is to usurp the prerogative of Jehovah. Every man has a right to his own body, to the products of his own labor, to the protection of the law, and to the common advantages of society. It is piracy to buy or steal a native African and subject him to servitude. Surely the sin is as great to enslave an American as an African." So by this time, we're getting close to the Civil War. Population in the U.S. of slaves has grown to 4 million. And we have two parties in America, the Democrat Party, pro-slavery, Andrew Jackson, and the Whigs. Now, that's not necessarily because they wore the wigs, but it goes back to Britain. They were the opposition party to the king. And so you had the Whigs in America that were sort of the opposition party to what was going on. But by this time, the Whigs were more of a big tent party, and they weren't really standing for anything. So the Democrat Party, in a sense, was pro-choice regarding whether or not you should own slaves. And the other party was the Whigs, and they became such a big tent party that people started leaving it, starting other parties called the Free Soil Party or the Know Nothing Party. that's an interesting name. And so though many Whigs were against slavery, they took a weak stance, wanting to be in the big tent. And so, again, the abolitionist movement was not started by caliphs in Arabia or Hindu Brahmin in India or czars in Russia or Ottoman sultans or the Ashanti, which was a tribe in Africa that was not just selling other Africans into slavery, but selling them for human sacrifice. And this Ashanti tribe, they had all these sacrifice grounds. Okay, this is when we kill people to cleanse the grave when a chief dies. And this is where we kill people when it's a new moon, we're having a celebration. And this is when they had all this, the whole thing was in, and they would sell, "Oh, you need some slaves for your sacrifice? Okay, here." Anyway, so these other different dynasties and so forth all had slavery. And the abolitionist movement was founded by Christians in America, notably the Quakers, Anthony Benezet and so forth, and the Methodists with John Wesley, who hated it, and then the Second Great Awakening preachers, and then in England, John Newton, William Wilberforce. Charles Finney, Second Great Awakening preacher, starts Oberlin College, and he graduates. Mary Jane Patterson, the first black woman to graduate from college. And he has his Oberlin College be a stop on the Underground Railroad. So they sneak slaves out of the South to the North and eventually to Canada. And now new territories are coming in to America. We got the Louisiana Purchase, doubling the size of the country, 827,000 square miles. And then Florida comes in, and then Texas, and then Oregon Territory, Mexican Secession. And so the country's got new territories that are coming in as states. And so the southern states realize that if this territory comes in as free states, they can vote to outlaw slavery, and then they're going to have to give up their slaves, and they don't like that. And so what do? They want to hurry up and send people into these territories so they'll come into the Union as slave states. And so during this time, you have the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and there's a Democrat president, Millard Fillmore, and he pushes through the Fugitive Slave Law. which is what? Which is if a slave escapes from the south and goes north. If you're a citizen in the north, you have to help return them. And so there were whole states that refused to obey the federal government. The federal government would come in, catch a slave, and the local sheriff would say, you're not going to keep him in my jail. And then there were other ones that the whole jury would say he's innocent. And they would be so upset. And they wouldn't enforce the federal mandate. Wow, isn't that interesting? So you had a pro-slavery Democrat senator from Illinois named Stephen Douglas. And he proposed that Kansas have the free choice as to come into the Union as a free state or a slave state. Let them decide. And so you had all these slave owners from the South flooding into Kansas, and so it's called Bleeding Kansas. And they set up two legislatures, and they would, like, fight each other and kill each other, and it was really bloody. And here's Ohio. They have an anti-slavery movement, and so this is 1841. Dramatic trial within these walls contested whether a runaway slave could be extradited from Ohio and returned to the South. Judge Samuel Bancroft ruled that Ohio's extradition law was unconstitutional. And nice to have people saying that some laws are unconstitutional. Then you have a preacher, and this is Henry Ward Beecher, and he's like the most popular preacher in America. And he is against the fugitive slave law. And you know what he does? He raises money at church to buy people's freedoms. He actually bought the chains that John Brown wore when he was in jail. And he drug him across the podium when he was preaching, and he stomps on him. And he actually has a slave auction at church. Now, it's not to sell a slave, but he has somebody standing in, and all the church is like bidding and raising money, and they raised $900, and with that money, they bought a girl's freedom. Her name was Pinky, and then afterwards, she goes to the church, and she thanks the church for buying her freedom. And modern-day ministry that does that is Christian Solidarity International. And Eric Metaxas and others are promoting this, where you can give money, and this money will be used to buy Africans out of slavery right now today. And Henry Ward Beecher's sister is Harriet Beecher Stowe, and she wrote the famous novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. And communities insisted on jury trials before the alleged fugitive could be taken away. Some juries refused to convict, and But one of the big ones is Joshua Glover. So let me get to him. Joshua Glover was a slave, and he made it all the way to Wisconsin. And the fugitive slave law, signed by Democrat President Millard Fillmore, you had a slave catcher catch Joshua Glover and put him in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin jail. And you had about 5,000 white Wisconsins storm the jail and free Joshua Glover. And here's the historical marker. Rescue of Joshua Glover. Joshua Glover was a runaway slave who sought freedom in Racine in 1852. 1854, his Missouri owner used the Fugitive Slave Act to apprehend him. 1850 law permitted slave catchers to cross state lines, capture him, escape. Glover was taken to Milwaukee and imprisoned. Word spread about Glover's incarceration, and a great crowd gathered around the jail demanding his release. They beat down the jail door, release Joshua Glover. He eventually was escorted to Canada. And I think it's interesting. Here's what the newspaper, the Sauk County Standard, said in 1854. An estimated 5,000 white Republicans stormed the jail. Right, there's the free Joshua Glover. Free Joshua Glover now. 2 days after these white Wisconsins free Joshua Glover, they go to Ripon, Wisconsin, and they form an anti-slavery party called the Republican Party. And the historical marker says, the Glover incident helped galvanize abolitionist sentiment in Wisconsin. The case eventually led to the state Supreme Court to defy the federal government by declaring the fugitive slave law unconstitutional. So the Republican Party original platform was to eliminate slavery and polygamy. So in 1856, it adopts its first party platform. The convention of delegates are opposed to the extension of slavery into free territory. With our Republican fathers, we hold it to be self-evident truth that all men are endowed with the inalienable right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that the primary object and ulterior design of our federal government were to secure these rights to all persons. Our Republican fathers abolished slavery in all our national territory, the Northwest Ordinance. Remember, I talked about that already. It becomes our duty to maintain this provision against all attempts to violate it for the purpose of establishing slavery. We deny the authority of Congress to give legal existence to slavery. Can you imagine a party saying we're going to... It is both the right and the imperative duty of Congress to prohibit in the territories those twin relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. Now, polygamy, what's that? Well, that's where a guy can have lots of wives. So here you had the Republican Party founding by saying marriage is one man and one woman. And to eliminate slavery. Anti-slavery Republicans organized in other states, and they were aided by church members. Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Methodists. Here's one. Anti-Slavery Society in Michigan was held. The society met at the First Presbyterian Church. And Michigan held the first state Republican convention. Then Indiana did. And then Ohio did. And then New York did. And then they've had the first Republican convention. The first Republican convention, Pittsburgh, 1856, called on Americans to what? Resist and overthrow the present national administration of Democrat President Franklin Pierce. We're going to resist and overthrow the... And as it is identified with the progress of the slave power to national supremacy. And they had their nominating convention. They selected John C. Fremont to be the first presidential candidate. He lost, but Nixon then won the next time around. Now, this is interesting. This is the first African Baptist church in Richmond, Virginia. And in 1865, it hosted the first Republican state convention in Virginia. Virginia's first Republican convention was held in the first African Baptist church. And 1857, Supreme Court, 7 of the 9 are Democrats, justices. They decide that Dred Scott was not a citizen but property. And I actually served for years on the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation, and they successfully... were able to put a statue of Dred Scott and his wife Harriet at the foot of the courthouse in St. Louis, Missouri, the old courthouse that they were he was sold on. Now there's a statue of him there. Lynn Jackson is the woman who's the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott, and so she has that up. And anyway, Roger Taney that decided the Dred Scott case was put on by Democrat Andrew Jackson, and Taney wrote this in his Dred Scott decision, that slaves were so far inferior that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his own benefit. Talk about racism. And then 1856, pro-slavery Democrat Preston Brooks sneaks up on the abolitionist Republican Senator Charles Sumner and beats him nearly to death on the floor of the U.S. Capitol. Right? Charles Sumner had given a speech. He says that slavery is the mistress of the South, and you know all this. And he's like, and so the next day, all the Democrats show up with pistols, and it's like, okay, you know. So let's see here. By the if you're not familiar, Dred Scott had been a slave, taken with his master to Illinois, Wisconsin, but he didn't read, so he didn't know the newspapers that he could have just walked away from his master because those were free states. And then when he gets back to Missouri, he has some friends that help him sue for his freedom. And one of them is Henry Blow, a Republican congressman, whose wife started the first kindergarten in the United States. And my, anyway, my dad's was a historian, and he did the historical marker in Carondelet, Missouri, and that's where the Blow family lived. And so he put that on the marker. So Lincoln... he didn't believe that we should honor the Dred Scott decision. He says, we think the Dred Scott decision is erroneous. We know that the court that made it has often overruled its own decisions, and we shall do what we can to have it overrule this. So imagine the Supreme Court making erroneous decisions. And then in his inaugural address, he says, if the policy of the government on vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decision of the Supreme Court, the instant they are made, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. So we're the in charge, right? Not them. They're our servants. And so we have the, amen. Now, I thought this was interesting. Prior to the Civil War, the country was divided geographically from north to south. So you had the radical Republican North that said slavery is wrong, end it now. Right? Abolitionist societies, underground railroads, and so forth. Moderate Republican North that says slavery is wrong, but we got to transition out of it slowly over time. You want to make sure that they can support themselves before you push them off the plantation. And then the practical neutral that didn't care about that. They just care about jobs and economy and checks and so forth. And then the moderate Democrat South that said slavery is wrong, but it's been here for centuries. Just treat your slave nice. And then the extreme Democrat South that said slavery is good. Let's expand it to all these new Western territories that are coming into the Union. And so let's go through those real quick. Radical Republican North, slavery is wrong, end it now. Moderate North, transition of it out of it over time. Practical neutral, they cared only about jobs, finances. Moderate Democrat South, wrong, but live with it. Extreme Democrat South, slavery should be expanded. I thought it was interesting. Those same categories are today with the pro-life. So you have the pro-life Republicans, abortion is wrong, end it now. Then the establishment rhino Republicans, take your time. And then the practical neutrals only care about welfare checks and jobs and economy. And the pro-choice Democrats, it's a wrong, but, you know, live with it and treat, have it be rare and safe and so forth. And then the extreme pro-choice Democrats, they want it to be expanded. They want you to pay for it, even the little sisters of the poor that, you know, take vows of chastity, you know. And then they want to use the United Nations to push it around the world. And Reagan noticed the similarity that I just showed you. He wrote in Conscience of the Nation, Lincoln recognized that we could not survive as a free land when some men could decide that others were not fit to be free and should be slaves. Likewise, we cannot survive as a free nation when some men decide that others are not fit to live and should be abandoned to abortion. I mean, it's geographic, right? You're 2 inches over the border from, Kentucky into Illinois, and you're free. You're 2 inches over the border from Illinois into Kentucky, you're property. You're 2 inches outside of the womb, you're a citizen. You're 2 inches in the room, you're property. You can, you know. Reagan said, whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally. So Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, and some consider that an overreach because it's a proclamation, it's not a law. So then he turns around and he spends a whole lot of effort to pass the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. And every Republican congressman votes for it, and every Republican senator. Only 4 Democrats and the Senate and 15 in the House vote for it. Once Southern Democrats were forced to free their slaves, they attempted to re-enslave them by passing what's called black codes. So they would say, yeah, you're free, but you got to have a job, and if we catch you without a job, then we're going to make, you know. They required former slaves to be apprenticed to employers, which is basically you're back in slavery, and punished if they left. And sharecroppers weren't any better off. Many Southern states in the black codes prohibited blacks from owning weapons. No freedman, Negro, or mulatto shall carry or keep firearms or ammunition. Mississippi Black Code, 1865. Could you imagine the government not wanting you to have guns? On November 1865, Republicans denounced Mississippi's Democrat legislature for being systemically racist. The black codes and, let's see. So there's a Republican, Thaddeus Stevens, introduces a bill to give former slaves 40 acres and a mule. Democrats opposed it, led by President Andrew Johnson. Republicans overrode Andrew Johnson's veto to pass Civil Rights Act of 1866, conferring right to citizenship on freed slaves, to force Southern states to extend the rights of state citizenship to former slaves. Republicans pushed through the 14th Amendment. 100% of Democrats voted against the 14th Amendment. And Republican John Farnsworth says the reason for the adoption of the 14th Amendment was because of discriminating legislation of those states by which they were punishing one class of men under different laws from another class. And then they had Jim Crow laws and to keep the former slaves from voting. Republicans granted voting rights to former slaves in the District of Columbia, overriding again Democrat Andrew Johnson's veto. They passed another legislation protecting voting rights of all freed slaves, overriding the Democrat President Johnson's veto. And then the Republicans begin to impeach President Andrew Johnson. And then Democrats in Georgia's Senate expel black civil rights activist Tunis Campbell and 24 other black Republicans. They just kick him out, but then they're later reinstated by the Republican Congress. Republicans push through the 15th Amendment guaranteeing freed slaves the right to vote. And Tuskegee Institute recorded that between 1882 and 1968, there were 4,743 lynchings. There were more than those, but those are documented. And out of those, 3,446 were blacks, and 1,297 were white radical Republicans down in the South registering freed blacks to vote. Think of that. Almost one out of every four or five lynchings was a white Republican that was lynched because they were down in the South registering the freed blacks to vote. Spanish-American War, the blacks and whites fought together. General Pershing says, white regiments, black regiments representing young manhood of the North and South fought shoulder to shoulder, unmindful of race or color, unmindful of whether commanded by ex-Confederate or not, and mindful of only their common duty as Americans. Then you have black codes, the separate but equal, and the dumpy train cars were the ones that the blacks were forced to be on. So there's a case, 1892, black man Homer Plessy was arrested for violating Louisiana's Separate Car Act. Supreme Court upheld the racial discrimination in Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, calling it separate but equal. But defying that, 1901, Republican President Theodore Roosevelt hosts the first black man to have dinner in the White House, Booker T. Washington. And he caught flack for that from the South. And 1914, Woodrow Wilson is back in charge, and he segregates the military, reversing 50 years of integration. And Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, has a filming of a KKK film in the White House. And he considers Plessy versus Ferguson as a stare decisis, settled law. And so he says, segregation is not humiliation, but a benefit, and distinctly to the advantage of the color. He's trying to talk him into it. And then he segregates the Army, Navy, Postal Service, Treasury, and so forth. And this was PragerU did this. And it says, Woodrow Wilson shared many views of the KKK and so forth. And so 1921, Democrat right supremacists destroy Tulsa's Black Wall Street, killing 300, leaving 10,000 homeless. Now, it's sort of interesting that critical race theory tries to say, well, it was black versus white. No, it's Democrat versus Republican. It's not a racial issue. It's a political issue. And anyway, FDR appoints a KKK member, Hugo Black, to the Supreme Court. As the Justice Black revealed, the Ku Klux Klansman. And to gain support of the Democrat South, FDR agrees to block enforcement of anti-lynching laws. And then another little side chapter is during World War II, the Imperial Japanese Army had Korean, Chinese, Philippine comfort women, one woman for every 70 soldiers. And the Japanese women who volunteered during the war for factory work or to be nurses, they were taken and made into comfort women, right? Again, this fallen, selfish human nature. And it comes in all colors, but what matters is the software that's running on the brain. Is it love your neighbor or is it selfish? And then you have Democrat Congressman Lyndon Johnson from Texas. When there was a civil rights bill, he goes, this civil rights bill is a farce and a sham. I'm opposed to that program. I have voted against the so-called poll tax repeal bill, and I have voted against the so-called anti-lynching bill. There was a bill to stop lynching, and he votes against it. During World War II, Republican General Eisenhower forbade racism and made the decision to arm black American soldiers with weapons. 1948, Democrat candidate for president Strom Thurmond says there's not enough troops in the army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools. 1952, 1956, a majority of black Americans vote for a Republican, President Dwight Eisenhower. 1953, Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, chaired a committee to eliminate discrimination on the basis of race and color in the employment practices of the federal government. 1954, Supreme Court justices reject the stare decisis or the settled law of Plessy versus Ferguson, and they get rid of separate but equal, and they have Brown versus the Board of Education prohibiting racial discrimination. Eisenhower immediately orders desegregation of the Washington, D.C. public schools. And then Eisenhower proposes a civil rights bill to enforce the 15th Amendment, strengthening the rights of blacks to vote. Democrat Senator Strom Thurmond filibusters Eisenhower's civil rights bill for 24 hours. And instead of voting for Eisenhower's civil rights bill, Democrat Senator John F. Kennedy delayed it by voting to have it sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Doris Kearns Goodwin writes in the book Lyndon Johnson, The American Dream, quoted Democrat Senator Lyndon Johnson telling Democrat Senator Richard Russell regarding the Civil Rights Act of 1957, "These Negroes are getting pretty uppity these days, and that's a problem for us since they've got something now they've never had before, the political pull to back up their uppityness. Now we've got to do something about this. We've got to give them a little something, just enough to quiet them down, not enough to make a difference." LBJ goes on, "For if we don't move at all, then their allies will line up against us and there'll be no way of stopping them. We'll lose the filibuster. There'll be no way of putting a brake on all sorts of wild legislation. It will be Reconstruction all over again." What's Reconstruction? That's after the Civil War, Ulysses S. Grant had the federal troops down in the South to prevent discrimination. So, September 4th, 1957, Democrat Arkansas Governor Orville Fabus stood at the door of the Central High School in Little Rock with the Arkansas National Guard and blocked 9 black students from coming inside. Southern Democrat governors resisted desegregation. Republican Eisenhower was hated by Democrat governors for sending troops south to force racial integration of the public schools, as he had previously integrated the military. Democrat Birmingham Commissioner Bull Connor, who had close ties with the KKK, stated in 1957, "Segregation laws are still constitutional, and I promise you that until they are removed from the ordinance books of Birmingham, they will be enforced in Birmingham to the utmost of my ability and by all lawful means." Now, Birmingham, that's where Republican former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was from. And she was on The View in 2018 regarding Democrat Bull Connor. She says, "Let me tell you why I'm a defender of the Second Amendment. I was a little girl growing up in Birmingham, Alabama in the late 50s, early 60s. There was no way that Bull Connor, a Democrat, and the Birmingham police were going to protect you. And so when the White Knight Riders would come through our neighborhood, my father and his friends would take their guns and they'd go to the head of the neighborhood. It's a little cul-de-sac. And they would fire in the air if anybody came through. I don't think they actually ever hit anyone, but they protected the neighborhood. I'm sure that if Bull Connor had known where those guns were, he would have rounded them up. And so I don't favor some things like gun registration." Now, I just thought I'd put this in here. Again, more slavery today than any other time in world history. These are current news headlines. More than 200 children remain abducted in Nigeria and kidnapped. I was driving, I don't know, I go a lot of places, and I have my Uber driver was from Nigeria. And he said, is it Yoruba tribe? There's the Igbo and the Yoruba, and then there's another tribe. And he goes, it's the other tribe that's Islamic with Boko Haram. And he says, it's horrible. They're kidnapping kids all the time. And he says, there's videos of them going onto a bus and they're asking them their tribe, what tribe they were. And if they say the wrong one, they just kill them right there and they get it on their camera. He says, it's horrible. He says, they're on the verge of a civil war. Why aren't everybody that hates racism, so why aren't they talking about what's really happening right now in Nigeria and coming to their defense and stopping that injustice? These are black lives that matter in Nigeria. Here's another one. Nigerian gangs kidnap children on behalf of Boko Haram. So back to my history, and if I keep your attention a little longer. Is this interesting?
Yes.
I always hope I don't do information overload, but you can. So in 1958, Republican President Eisenhower meets with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in the White House. Eisenhower proposed a civil rights bill in 1959, but Senate Democrats filibustered it and watered it down. 1959, when Southern Democrats demanded that this proposed civil rights bill include a provision that if anyone violated the law, they should be tried before an all-white jury. And Republican Vice President Nixon gave the deciding vote against that Democrat addition to the bill. And then Alabama's Democrat Governor George Wallace in 1963 blocks the entrance of the University of Alabama, stating, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And that same year was when Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gives his I Have a Dream speech. And he refers to Democrat Governor George Wallace in his I Have a Dream speech. He says this, I have a dream that one day down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. So federal troops escorted black students to class. Democrats in the South, after the Birmingham children's protest in 1963, where police dogs and fire hoses were used against blacks, Kennedy called for a bill emulating the Republican Civil Rights Act of 1875. But the Southern Democrats opposed this. And a former KKK Klansman, Senator Robert Byrd, the longest-serving Democrat senator and the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Byrd admitted, you had to be in the Klan to advance in the Democrat Party. And Democrat Secretary of State Hillary Clinton praised Byrd in a eulogy. Today our country has lost a true American original, my friend and mentor, Robert Byrd. It's almost impossible to imagine the United States Senate without Robert Byrd. He was not just the longest serving member, he was its heart and soul. From my first day in the Senate, I sought out his guidance. 1964, the Democrat senators, look at this, from March 10th to March 30th to June 10th, they had a filibuster of a civil rights bill. Democrat Senator Albert Gore Sr. and these others, for 71 days, the United States Senate was completely frozen with a filibuster, and the Democrats opposed the civil rights bill. The Democrat Senator Richard Russell, 1964, says, we will resist to the bitter end any movement which would have a tendency to bring about social equality and intermingling and amalgamation of the races in our southern states. Democrat Senator Strom Thurmond during this time said, this so-called civil rights proposal with which the president has sent to Capitol Hill for enactment into law are unconstitutional, unnecessary, unwise, extend beyond the limits of reason. This is the worst civil rights package ever presented to Congress, and is reminiscent of the Reconstruction proposals and actions of the Radical Republican Congress. He's referring back to the, right after the Civil War, the Radical Republicans, right? They were wanting to give freedom and all the rights. He says, we're going to go back to that. This is 1964. They're still identifying with that. So June 10th, 1964, Senator Byrd, that Hillary liked, he filibustered the civil rights bill for 14 hours and 13 minutes. Now, LBJ, he saw the political winds shifting. And so he had a watered-down compromise bill proposed, and he signed it. And Dinesh D'Souza pointed out in the Independent Whig, September 1st, 2016, more Republicans proportionally voted for that Civil Rights Act in 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 and the Fair Housing Bill of 1968 than Democrats did. Lyndon Johnson immediately followed up by introducing his Great Society entitlement welfare programs. It was a Cloward-Piven strategy to backdoor the country into socialist dependency. So it's like, okay, we're going to do the Civil Rights Bill, and we're not going to intimidate them at the voting booth like we've done. We're going to do something new. Richard Clown and Francis Piven were Columbia University sociologists, and they were left-leaning political activists. And so they came up with a backdoor way to get the country into socialism. And it's a strategy involved virtue signaling or posing to care for the poor, while the real purpose was to create a permanent class of dependent voters. And I showed this before, but this was the 1934 Chicago Tribune cartoon. And if you zoom in on it, that's the plan of action for the U.S. spend, spend, spend. Right, under these welfare programs. And then it says it here, depleting the resources. And then that little sign on there, it says, young pinkies from Columbia and Harvard. You can't really see it there. But Columbia University is where Cloward and Piven were. So he's talking about this. So LBJ did the big switch. The big switch is not Republicans and Democrats switching places regarding race issues. It was the Democrat Party switching tactics on how to manipulate minority voters. And the switch was from intimidation to entitlement. Did you catch that? They want to control, but instead of doing it through hosing them down and sicking dogs, you create a Cloward-Piven dependent class. And if you think of it for a moment, it's very powerful. Imagine if you were getting a $1,000 check in the mail every week from someone you didn't know. Week after week, month after month, $1,000, $1,000. After a few years of that, would you ask yourself, who is sending me this $1,000 check every week? I'm going to find out who they are and vote them out of office. Would anybody do that? I mean, I'd be like, well, my kid's got a few more bills to pay, right? Once you get people to receive free money from you, you have a very strong pull for them to want to keep you in office. It's a election strategy. In other words, instead of suppressing African-American vote through intimidation, control them through dependency on entitlement programs. Now, according to Ron Kessler's book, Inside the White House, written in 1996, Lyndon Johnson had a reputation of vulgarity in private conversations, and believe me, some of the stuff written are really, really vulgar. But LBJ told two hesitant Democrat governors aboard Air Force One, and again, this is in the book, Inside the White House, Ron Kessler, who served with all kinds of presidents. So LBJ tells these Democrat governors, if they go along with his switch from intimidation to entitlement, he says, I'll have those, and then he uses the N-word, voting Democrat for the next 200 years. And even Malcolm X noticed this. 1963, he says, the liberal is more deceitful and hypocritical than the conservative. The white liberal is the one who has perfected the art of posing as the Negro's friend. The white liberal is able to use the Negro as a pawn or weapon in this political football game. The white liberal controls this ball through tricks and tokenism and false promises. Well, just a little bit up to date. Patrice Cullors, founder of the BLM, she says, we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia are part of the trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are superverse on sort of ideological theories. So, trained Marxists. What's the Marxist theory? It's critical theory. It's critical race theory, critical economic. You divide the country into groups, and then you pit the groups against each other to cause division and domestic instability and insecurity, and then everybody panics, and they'll surrender their freedoms to the government that promises to restore peace. That's the trained Marxist theory that she's talking about. So you, again, you send in agitators, organizers, agent provocateurs, and their goal is to stir up rioting, and then when the people get panicky enough, they usurp power. So you create a problem that's real bad. Everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. That becomes the new starting point. You create another problem that's real bad. Everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. Then you create another problem that's real bad. Everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. This is the Marx. This is the theory. And each time you settle, the people give up a little more of their freedoms, a little more, until it's all reconcentrated back into the state. Now, Patrice Cullors was trained by Eric Mann. He was a leader of the Weather Underground in the 1970s. What's the Weather Underground? Oh, well, you know them because they bombed New York City's police headquarters and bombed San Francisco's police department and killed policemen, and they bombed the U.S. Capitol. They did? Yeah, it was in the news. March 1st, 1971. Talk about an insurrection attack on the Capitol. But they're on the left, so they get off the hook. And so one of the Weather Underground people is Bill Ayers, and he launched the political career of Barack Obama. And then another BLM founder, Opal Tometi, is there with the Marxist dictator Nicolas Maduro. And on their BLM website, they had this accessed on June 12, 1920. We make space for transgendered. Work to dismantle cisgendered privilege and uplift trans folk, especially trans women. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family. We foster queer-affirming network, freeing ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking, or rather, the belief that all in the world are heterosexuals unless she, he, or do they disclose otherwise. It's like, what did you just say? it's a bait and switch. A whole lot of people that thought BLM was going to do had no clue that the three founders are trans activists wanting to destroy the family, doing all kinds of this kind of stuff. And I did screenshots of the page just in case they had ever taken it down. So one of the black men that was disillusioned and became a communist was Manning Johnson. I mentioned him before. And he was a communist for 10 years, ran for Congress in New York as a communist. And then he realized that the communists didn't want to help his people, right? And he mentioned that in his book. You can go online. The website's still up there, but I also quote him in my book on socialism. But he talks about how there were some successful black businessmen that wanted to build a real estate development and have it be beautiful with fountains and streets. And they sabotaged it. And then some other black businessmen wanted to build a first-class hospital. He says, Jews have hospitals, Catholics, everybody. And they wanted to have it, and it got sabotaged. And he saw them sabotage. He goes, they really don't want to help us. They want to keep us going so they can use us to sow division. Sort of like Yasser Arafat in the Middle East, right? So all the different countries, they absorb people, but Yasser Arafat wanted to keep the Palestinians unabsorbed so that he can maintain and use them to bring division. And anyway, so Manning Johnson, in his book, Color Communism and Common Sense, foreword is written by Archibald Roosevelt, the son of Teddy Roosevelt. He writes this: after 2 years of practical training in organizing street demonstrations and inciting mob violence and how to fight the police, throw a brick and hide. I put this in there because Patrice Cullor says that she was a trained Marxist, right? So this is him who said this is what his training was. I was given an intensive course in the theory and practice of red political warfare that changed me from a novice into a dedicated red professional revolutionist. But some people are seeing through it. I thought this was interesting. NBA player Charles Barkley said, man, I think most white people and black people are great people. But I think our system is set up where our politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are designed to make us not like each other, so they can keep their grasp of money and power. They divide and conquer. And I thought this was an interesting quote from Burgess Owens, former NFL player. Yahoo News has the article. And he says, on the concept of reparation, Burgess Owens, formerly of the Jets and Raiders, spoke during hearing for H.R. 40, I used to be a Democrat until I did my history and found the misery that party brought to my race. Let's pay restitution. How about the Democrat Party pay for all the misery brought to my race? Now, again, I point out that it is the software, not the hardware. It's the people need to get born again. And if they truly get born again, they're going to love everybody and do unto the least of these what you do unto Jesus. That's the answer. It's not political. The word politics comes from the Greek word polis, which means city. So politics is simply the business of the city. You look at the founding of America. I have a book called Who is the King? And America, it's you. But I go through colonial New England. You have the Baptists founded Providence, Rhode Island, and the Congregationalists founded Hartford, Connecticut. There was nobody else in Hartford except the Congregationalist Christians, and they had to be involved in the business of the city. I mean, they couldn't sit back because there wasn't anybody but the Christians, right? You look at John Wheelwright and his church found Exeter, New Hampshire. There's nobody in Exeter, New Hampshire except his church member because they founded the city. So everybody in the church was involved in the business of the city, right? So this idea of, oh, we're not supposed to get involved, it's like, that's something they're pushing on us. And anyway, well, in trying to find a place to land, I thought, I've read a lot of history. And you've been so kind as to listen to a lot of history. And one of the things I've seen is that every single generation has a crisis. Bubonic plague, Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, World War I, Spanish flu. And you know what? If we get through our present crisis, there'll be another one. We get through that crisis, there'll be another one. Jesus says the wheat and tares grow together till the harvest. There's always going to be crises. We want to turn things around. We really, really do. And we're going to work to do that. But it's almost like the Lord knows that there's going to be crises. And he, I'm part of a group, and they, for years, you know, were fighting the Soviet Union. Finally, the wall comes down, and there's no more communism. And then, you know, and now we've got the Sharia Islam threat, and then we got the social. I've been around long enough, so I've been through a couple of these battles. There's always going to be battles. And it's almost like the Lord knows what time period that you're living. He chose for you to be alive at this time period. He knows all the dirty deals, all the back room. He knows everything that I just shared with you. And he thinks you've got what it takes. And it's like the crisis of the era is a self-sorting out on a mini level of the sheep and the goats. It's not the ultimate sorting out of the sheep and the goats. When, Lord, were you naked and we clothed you? It's not that, but it's on a small level. The crisis of the era is an opportunity for the people that are alive in that era to show whose side they're on. Are you going to run and hide? Are you going to give up? Are you going to, like it says in, what was that scripture that says, if pretend like I'm not seeing it, but the Lord knows you do see it, but you're just going to sort of ignore it? Is your goal in life to tiptoe from one side to the other without stepping on a landmine and just hope you get to the end and die without having to go through any confrontation? So, freshman chemistry class. There is a beaker with a solution, and you pour in a catalyst, and it causes a reaction. And some stuff precipitates and gets heavy and falls to the bottom, and other stuff gets effervescent and bubbly and floats to the top. The time period that you are living in is the solution in the beaker. The catalyst that's poured in is the crisis of the time period. And some people precipitate and drop out and run and hide and get scared and fearful. And other people get effervescent and get bubbly. And they say, Lord, use me. There's a crisis out there. Use me to love the unlovable. Use me to defend the defenseless. Use me to stand up for righteousness. Use me when it looks hopeless. You know the early church? I mean, the church was born into a one-world anti-Christian government, the Roman Empire. Evidently, God's not afraid. And for three centuries, that was a Christian experience. And they prayed for what? That the crisis would go away? No, they prayed for boldness. And so the idea is the Lord is looking at how we act. And it's exciting. You know, I was thinking, especially us guys, we like conflict. I mean, I hate to say you don't, but you do. I mean, I'm one of 11 kids. I got five brothers. And growing up, we would, like, fight all the time. I mean, if there's nothing, we'd walk down a road, and there'd be one brother would pick up a little piece of gravel, and he would, like, plink it at the other brother's head. For no other reason than just to the other one would pick up a little one, and he'd plink it back, and the other one would pick up one. And then the rocks would get a little bit bigger. Then they get bigger until pretty soon you're, like, pelting each other with rocks. And I found if you're ever in a rock fight, with your left hand, throw a handful really high, and then you can wing some line drives. But imagine if there was nothing to do, right? You get to heaven, and there's all the great saints, and they're talking about standing up to Pharaoh and standing up to Goliath, and they go, oh, what did you do? Because it was all done by the time I came around. I mean, all the babies were fed, all the diseases were cured. They're going to say, boring. So for the rest of eternity, you'll be known as the boring story guy, you know? We sort of crave it. You know, one time I was like, imagine if you could, like, go away to an island and be away from all these problems. And it'd be pretty nice for, you know, for a day, a couple days, a week, a couple weeks, a couple months. After a while, you'd probably go crazy. It's like, what's going on back there? I want to know what's going on. And then what if you knew, like, one of your family members, and they're, like, in a situation, you go, oh, I know the answer. I mean, one time I thought about being in heaven. You know, I ran for Congress three times. I ran against Dick Gephardt. He was the Nancy Pelosi before the Nancy Pelosi. And he spent $9 million trying to destroy me. That's sort of, not too many people get that opportunity, you know. I mean, he'd run negative ads against me every day, and I mean, all kinds of stuff. And my kids and I would be like, we didn't know that, you know. One of my books, it's called America's God and Country, Encyclopedia Quotations. It sold 500,000 copies. I mean, had the U.S. Supreme Court even cited by name in 2014. And Anyway, he did a commercial, and he at a debate, he took the video, and he froze, this is back in the year 2000, froze the frames with my eyes were half closed, so I look like I'm inebriated, and the screen's black and white, and it says, Bill Feder, Too Extreme from Missouri, and has my book slide across the screen, and then it says, you know, Too Extreme from Missouri, and he played that every day, every day, every day. People say, what's the, oh, and they'd say that I don't know how they found it, that some group in Montana called the Montana Militia had a website where they had hundreds of books, and mine was one of the books. And so the ad was him in color with all the old people and little children. Then it turns black and white with my eyes half open. And this book, and Two Extremes from Missouri, and he even supplies books to the Montana Militia. People, what's that? I don't know. And so like a couple years later, my brother asked me to speak at his child's class. You know how you get the grown-up to come and tell their career. And I did a book on George Washington Carver. And so I'm in front of the class, and the teacher says, now, this is Bill Feder. He's an author. And the one little kid raises his hand. I mean, the kid's feet don't even touch the floor. He goes, oh, I remember you, Bill Feder, Too Extreme from Missouri. You know, it's like, anyway, but during that time period, I thought, you know, oh, it'd just be nice just to, like, die and be in heaven and be with the Lord. It'd be so nice. It'd be so wonderful. And then I would think, oh, that's great. And then I would, after, you know, being up there for a couple of weeks, I'd be like, what's going back on, going on down on earth? And I'm going to look over the edge to see. And then I would sort of see, like, you know, I could have handled that. I could have handled a little bit more. I mean, that was, that, you know. Or maybe see one of your kids saying, look, they're facing a problem. Oh, I can help them. Oh, no, I can't help them. I'm already in heaven. I think that's what praise and worship does. Yeah. Praise and worship is an opportunity for us to escape and be in the presence of the Lord. And then we open our eyes, we're back down on earth, we can handle it again for another, you know, week or whatever. So anyway, so the idea is, just want to encourage you and let you know that someday you'll be dead. But you'll be in heaven because you believe that Jesus died on the cross to pay for all your sins. So I heard one person say, in heaven, you'll travel as fast as you think. And I'll probably show up late. So imagine in heaven, you're in heaven, you're walking the streets of gold, and you meet Moses. And Moses invites you over to his place. I don't know what it's like up there, but Jesus did say, in my Father's house there are many mansions. So I bet Moses will have a pretty nice place. He'll probably have one of those big fireplaces where the logs don't burn up. Get it? The burning bush in the wilderness didn't burn up, and the logs in his fireplace. Anyway. And, so I'll show up late, and my wife will say, where were you? I was thinking about something else, you know. But imagine being there, and maybe it's like tonight. Maybe he's got a big living room. And after all the small talk's over, you ask him, say, Moses, what was it like? I mean, I read the book. I even saw the movie. But here you are in person. The room will get quiet. Moses will stand up, and he goes, I was 80 years old. And Pharaoh, the most powerful military leader in the world, was charging at us with these brand-new chariot wheels and these sharp swords, and we were totally unarmed. And I just stood there holding out my staff, and I said, God, use me to deliver your nation. And the waves came in and swallowed up Pharaoh's chariots. We're going to say, wow. Then we're going to look around the room and see David. Say, David, tell us your story. The room will get quiet. David will stand up. He goes, I was just a teenager. And this thug Goliath was mocking our God and making fun of our faith. And these grown-ups were too chicken to do anything about it. I said, enough of that. I took my little sling and went out there and hit him in the head. And I took his own sword and I chopped his head off. We're going to say, wow. Then we're going to say, Gideon, tell us your story. Well, there's 100,000 Midianites. I got 30,000 Israelites, and God said, too many. Tell everyone that's scared to go home. Great, now I'm down to 10,000. Still too many. Go drink from a creek. Whittles it to 300. And then God says, okay, watch this. Right? God loves to wait till it looks hopeless, and then he raises up little nobodies. They're small in their own eyes and big in faith and courage. And then there's Deborah and the Apostle Paul. And one by one, everybody in Moses' living room is going to tell their story. It's going to be really exciting. And then everybody in the room is going to look at you. Says, you, we haven't heard from you yet. Tell us your story. What was going on earth when it was your turn to be down there? What were they saying about God in your country or the baby in the mother's womb, or marriage that God himself instituted? What did you do when the whole world was against you? What did you do when it looked hopeless? What did you do when you were even backstabbed by some of your Christian friends? What did you do? What did you do? You just kept your eyes on Jesus, right? And all that you had was a little thread of faith, but you trusted in the Lord, and it turned into a string and a rope and a cable, and finally the blessings of God came back into your life. You know, I'd hate for any of us to be up there and Jesus to walk in the room. And Jesus to have a big screen and show all kinds of great things happen and miracles and people coming to the Lord, and him saying, this is what I had planned for you to do, but you just didn't have enough faith and courage. And you look back at your life and that big mountain, that fear of man that held you back from doing everything, it's just a little anthill. And you said, I let that little anthill, that fear of man, hold me back from doing it. And you can't go back to earth and do anything else for Jesus because you're already in heaven because you believe that Jesus died on the cross to pay for all your sins. But guess what? We're still on this earth. We still have breath in our lungs. We still have feet that trod the soil. You still can do those courageous, faith-filled things that you will be known for forever. Out of the 6,000 years of world history, the good Lord decided for you to be alive right now. He's given you his word. He's given you his Holy Spirit. He's given you a great pastor with Jack Hibbs. He's given you everything. You can do this, right? So let's think of a basketball game. And you're on the bench, and Jesus is the coach. And he comes over, and he slaps you on the back, and he says, it's your turn. Get in the game. And you're like, but coach, they're playing really tough out there. Yeah, I know. It's your turn, get in the game. You're like, but somebody just got knocked down. He goes, yeah, I know. You're 7 feet tall, they are 4 feet tall. You can do this. Greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world. This is your time to do those things that you'll be known for forever. God bless you. Thank you.